that charged more while paying out smaller benefits. So, and in Italy, as, I mean, in Germany, just like in Italy, inflation substantially added to the German workers' hardship. There's something else both of these fascist leaders did. In both Italy and Germany, the process of privatization. Does that sound familiar? Ronald Reagan's dream. State-owned enterprises such as power plants, steel mills, banks, railways, insurance firms, steamship companies, and shipyards were handed over to private ownership for a song, I mean like gifts. Corporate taxes were reduced by half in both Italy and Germany. Does that sound familiar? Another Reagan achievement. Taxes on luxury items for the rich were cut. And inheritance taxes were either drastically lowered or abolished, just as they've been the last 10 years in America. And inheritance taxes...
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, listening to a broadcast of Michael Parenti's talk, The Functions of Fascism, talking about how fascism emerged in the 1920s and 1930s and how people fought back against it. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
And inheritance taxes were either drastically lowered or abolished, just as they've been the last 10 years in America. In Germany, between 1934 and 1940, the average net income of corporate businessmen rose by 46%. Enterprises that were floundering were refloated with state bonds. They were recapitalized out of the state treasury, and they were returned to private control when solvent. So you see, these are people who say socialism doesn't work, but when capitalist businesses start to fail, they go socialist. They take the money out of the public treasure and refloat these businesses. Does that sound familiar to you people who are worrying about the S&L bailout? With numerous enterprises, the state guaranteed a return on the capital invested. They guaranteed a return and assumed all the risk of investment losses. So the investor, the rich investor, didn't have to worry about any losses, and if his business didn't do well, he'd get the money from the state treasury in any way. This is why the capitalists did like fascism. This, however, did not really bring a final solution. I mean, what the fascist state is, it attempts a final solution to the problem of class conflict. It obliterates the demands of the working class and the democratic forms that allow workers some room for an organized defense of their interests. But this final solution proves very far from final. In fascist Italy and Germany, industrial sabotage and sporadic wildcat strikes continued, inflation increased, whole sectors of the economy remained stagnant, there was widespread corruption, mismanagement, underemployment, vital social services deteriorated, but profits climbed. The profits went up, yes sir. The gestures made on behalf of the needy were pitiful. I mean, what the Nazis used to do is go around in the working class areas and collect alms. So they taxed the poor to give money to the still poorer, as Franz Schumann once said. The Italian economy remained in a troubled, stagnant condition right up to the Second World War. In Germany, thanks to the booming armaments industry, the standard of living, at least most notably the unemployment problem, well, it had been so bad, that standard of living improved a little bit, but it never even reached, by the way, it never even reached what it was in 1933 under the Weimar Republic. I mean, it never reached 1928 levels. So even under the Weimar Republic, for all its troubles, the levels of food, textile, and other areas of consumption and production were much better than ever achieved under Nazi Germany. Anyone interested in reading more about fascism, I would direct you to a very fine book by Daniel Guérin, G-U-E-R-I-N, called Fascism and Big Business. The writings of Franz Neumann are also worth looking at. Now, my references on a couple of occasions here, I've made references to Reagan and Reaganism. I didn't mean to imply that Reagan was a fascist. Quite the opposite. I meant to point out that in the American context, Reaganism met the same crisis that was going on, a similar crisis, it wasn't quite the same, but accomplished the same things within the existing framework, the political framework of the existing political system. He broke unions, but he didn't use death squads and terror squads. He broke them using consultation corporations, advisory corporations, spending hundreds of millions of dollars showing companies how to break unions. They broke unions by instituting one of the most restrictive and prohibitive and difficult laws, the Taft-Hartley Law. That one goes back to 1940s, which make union organizing in America so very difficult. They've tried a number of times to limit our constitutional rights, the rights of free speech, the right to, of government accountability. They've cut inheritance taxes. They've cut the capital gains taxes. They've cut corporate taxes. They've abolished the progressive income tax. These are the accomplishments of the Ronald Reagan administration. While everyone talked about what a nitwit and a dingbat and a fool he was, Ronald Reagan did some very successful and brilliant things for his class. He rolled back the social democracy that had been developing in the late 60s and through the 70s. He cut back undermined human services. He staffed agencies and courts with people of in government who do not believe in government and do not even carry out the programs that Congress voted in. So within the American context, he's done quite a few things, short of what Hitler and Mussolini did as a final solution. And today I would also point out that in capitalist democracies in Western Europe and in the United States, the security forces have that same double standard that we discovered in Italy and in the Weimar Republic in Germany. Namely, they look the other way toward violence from the right, or seem to do very little, or seem seldom able to capture the perpetrators, unless the perpetrators are so crazy as to attack and kill police themselves. Then they go after them. But on the left, there's a constant surveillance, harassment, and in fact, sometimes outright murder. One can think of the systematic murder of the Black Panther Party, something like 30 of them killed in coordinated police attacks in cities throughout America. Or one can think of what's going on in West Germany, Italy, Belgium, Portugal today, where people on the left are being thrown in jail for astronomical sentences, while terrorists on the right seem to get by and get away with murder. Well, this is what we have to look at, and we have to understand that fascism is not just another ism out there. It's not just an aberration. It has a very rational side to it. It's a rational, functional form, and it can take diluted forms, and its propensities, its proclivities can exist even in the democratic state. That is, within that state, those police powers and those state powers can manifest some of the very same symptoms and all the worst attributes that you might find in a Nazi Germany or fascist Italy. Don't take my word for it. Just ask the CIA. Thank you. This is Michael Parenti with some real history.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
A familiar sound of summer. It's also a warning for kids to stay away. Every year, the War Amps enrolls children who are amputees due to lawnmower accidents, like Roan. He fell off a riding lawnmower, and the blade severed his leg.
Hey, I'm Roan. I'm a safety ambassador, and I have a message for all kids. Don't let it happen to you. Spot the danger before you play. Play safe!
Learn more at waramps.ca.
Close to Home, an eclectic mix of Canadian music on CFRU 93.3 FM. Thursday mornings at 7 a.m. with your host, Tom Rydell. I'll make it easier for you to get up and greet the day. Close to Home, Thursday mornings, 7 a.m.
Help drag cancer through the mud on Saturday, September 16th at the Canadian Cancer Society's Mademoiselle in Guelph. This 5K mud run is open to all fitness levels, so whether you're looking for a competitive obstacle race or just to enjoy a day of fun in the mud with your friends, head out to Cox Creek Cellars, 7687 Wellington Road 22, on September 16th. Whether you're a survivor or want to support a fighter, join your fellow Mademoiselles in raising funds for Canada's most promising cancer research and support services. Because when life gets messy, we stick together. Register today at mademoiselle.ca. This event is unfortunately not physically accessible.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and we were just listening to Michael Parenti's talk, The Functions of Fascism, where he described, like, basically who the fascists supported once they got in power in places like Italy and Germany, and who supported them as they were going into power, and how the police and the state forces in general in places like Italy and Germany treated them with kid gloves. You know, far-right groups in those societies could get away with murder without getting charged, or with an average, and had an average jail time in Germany of about 4 months in Weimar Republic if they actually got caught. You know, I mean, and of course we've talked about how in the, and he mentioned this too, I mean, how in the United States and modern Western countries, the far right gets away with all kinds of stuff, with like the left would never get away with, basically because it's not anti-capitalist. The far right is pro-capitalist. You know, it's pro the existing system. And is ultimately useful to the existing system. And we see how the capitalist class in Italy and Germany backed and financed and supported the rise to power of these different far-right groups in those societies based on their own interests and their interest to break labor unions, break unions of peasants and agricultural workers and eliminate all kinds of protections, labor protections and regulations and all this sort of stuff, just break it all down and use violence to break it all down in order to protect their profits. And we see when the Nazis and the fascists get into power in places like Italy and Germany, they completely deregulate the economy and give all these protections and all this like benefits to business while taking away from ordinary workers. You know, and doing things like cutting wages in half and reintroducing child labor and doing all this sort of thing. But what I want to do now that we've seen that, I want to offer a contrast, a very stark contrast. And I'm going to play a talk by Mike Preisner. Mike Preisner is an American communist. He's a leading figure in the PSL, the Party of Socialism and Liberation. And in this talk, which I'm about to play, he's going to talk about what it means to be a member of the PSL. You know, this one of the leading communist parties in the United States right now, and one of the most active in fighting against fascism and the far right. And I think basically he emphasizes what it means to be on the other side, what it means to actually be a communist, what it means to fight against fascism, what it means to stand for the rights of working people, what it means to fight in defense of oppressed people, whether that's immigrants, whether that's black people, whether that's indigenous people or whoever is oppressed by the capitalist state and the various racist forces that it enlists. You know, he's going to talk about what it means to be a communist. And, I can't really do justice to what he says here. It's very, very powerful. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. So this is Mike Preisner, what it means to be a member of the PSL. Please stay tuned.
Well, thanks to everyone who stuck around for the entire day, those who came late and decided to jump into workshops and stick around for the final plenary. I hope all of you got some enriching discussion, some education, and some interest in the things that we are active in. And hopefully you learn more about what our party is all about and why we exist and all the different various things that we are involved in. And on this closing panel, we heard a great... I'm going to kind of expand in some way on the talk that Yvonne gave about... I mean, Yvonne explained what we are as a party. Bruce explained why he joined the party. But I want to talk to you about what it means to join the PSL. Because we want everyone here who's not a member, whether you're a friend who knows us through political work, or whether you just maybe happened upon this conference while you were walking around campus, we want everyone in this room to seriously consider joining. So I want to tell you all what that means. Membership in the PSL is not like joining a club or getting a subscription to a political newspaper or something like that. We want to transform revolutionary ideas into reality, and that takes organization. Joining the PSL doesn't mean you simply volunteer to pass out flyers, or just come to study groups, or show up at a protest. Our members, from the moment they join, enter into a process of training, education, and political development, not just in theory, but in practice, in the streets. We seek to train and develop every member as an organizer, as a leader, as a skilled and effective fighter against the system. Our strength and striking power come from our own comrades. We want to be the best fighters, and we do that by working in common, learning from each other, studying together, fighting side by side, and gaining expertise as a unit. In the party, you learn a wide variety of things, how to write speeches and give them, to study politics and philosophy and how to teach others, to organize a protest, to lead it, to organize a political meeting, to lead it, to confront the police, the bosses, the state, to raise consciousness in our own communities. And in fact, a large number of the people that you've seen throughout this conference giving presentations and leading workshops, many of them a year ago hadn't been to a demonstration or hadn't been to a political meeting. And today, after a short period, there is no other people that you would want to be side by side with in the streets than these comrades. We don't just join. We train ourselves to be a vanguard force. We are training and recruiting a party of leaders, but not leadership as we see among most groups in bourgeois society. We don't seek leadership based on who is the most educated or who is the most articulate. A party like ours puts a different premium on leadership. In the PSL, leadership is based on desire to struggle, the desire to fight, the spirit of resistance. Our organization has theory called Marxism, but we don't read the Communist Manifesto or Marx like it's the Bible or like it's a religious dogma. We study Marxism as a living science, as a lens to look at the world, a way to understand the epoch we live in, to observe the basic laws of society, and to analyze our own existence within that society. But ultimately, we use Marxism and Lenin's teachings on party building as a guide to action, not just as a way to understand the world, but as a way to change it. We are an organization that does many things, much of that you've heard about throughout the course of this conference. Every day, our comrades are fighting to improve the lives of working people. This means we're dedicated anti-war activists in the streets the moment imperialism is on the march, that we work in labor unions, organizing against the bosses, and those of us who are not in unions join the picket lines when the unions are in struggle, that we fight for affordable tuition and against the cuts on our campuses, for tenant rights in our communities, to defend social services and healthcare. It means we struggle for immigrant rights and LGBT equality. It means we organize against racism and police brutality. We're in schools as high school students and college students, as teachers and professors. We're in workplaces, in unions, and we're even organizing amongst active duty soldiers in the military. Just in this past year, our party has organized mass protests against the war in Afghanistan, for the liberation of Palestine, for women's rights, against racism and police violence, actions against student debt, against state budget cuts, and for amnesty for immigrants, and much more. But the PSL is not just in Los Angeles. We're in Long Beach and Orange County. We're in Riverside and San Diego. And we're in states across the country, in New York, in Washington, in Massachusetts, in Florida, and beyond. Many, many more places. And since we're organized in a centralized party, we're able to take this message of revolutionary change to so many people across the country with a coordinated action plan. We can do these things because we have an organization. And every member becomes so much more effective when we are working together rather than alone. We work as a collective, supporting each other. And if the PSL's program that instead of groups and individuals fighting on these various issues, whether it's for immigrant rights or LGBT equality or jobs or healthcare, that we should fight together because these struggles are all connected. Our oppressor is the same. These are all the problems of capitalism. And this is why our party is unique. We want to build genuine unity among all sectors of oppressed people in society. And as Peter mentioned, you can see this within the ranks of our party, and the leaders and the organizers and the activists in our party, that we are multinational. We're Black, Brown, Arab, Asian, White, Native. We're old and young, high school students and retirees, gay and straight and trans. We're students, teachers, warehouse workers, letter carriers, retail workers, landscapers, and more. Our membership reflects the diversity and potential unity of U.S. society. We are different people, some of different backgrounds, but we share a trait that unites us, and that's optimism that things can and will change. And we are able to do all of these things I just mentioned, both training a professional organization of revolutionaries internally and waging a class struggle in the streets against the crimes of capitalism, because we are a party, and not just any type of organization. We are a revolutionary, working-class political party. And a political party is different from other types of organizations. It's an organization that aspires ultimately to holding political power. And we don't mean holding an individual political office or getting our party members elected. We mean power in the sense that the working class shapes and controls the government, not a tiny class of parasitic billionaire bankers. That means we just don't want concessions from the bankers, from the Wall Street CEOs. We don't think that those who created so much misery, so much hardship, such inhumanity and suffering should be worked with or compromised with or bargained with. We think they should go to jail. We think they should be punished. We think they should be swept away into the dustbin of history, and that they should have their vast, ill-begotten wealth seized by the people and used to enrich our lives and to push society forward toward justice, towards equality, and towards human solidarity. And this is no easy task. Right now, we live in a dictatorship of the rich, and we get to vote every 4 years, but only for the next CEO of the affairs of the capitalists. And, you know, we saw this with the last election. Of course, there were differences that were described earlier in the conference between the two candidates, but both are united on austerity, on maintaining the wars, on maintaining this social order. And there's no election about that. And since we live in a capitalist society that's dominated by capitalism, how does a socialist organization like the PSL ever conceive of coming to power? That question, our answer is revolution. Because, you know, will a rich minority that runs this country ever wake up and willingly turn over all of its power and wealth to create a new society based on the interests of the vast majority? Well, you can pretty much bet, you can 100% bet that that is not the way that society is going to change. It's going to take a fight. It's going to take a struggle, a people struggle, and that's why we're revolutionaries. We accept that a revolution is what we need. And although we fight for reforms in the short term, that is our long-term goal, is revolution. And, you know, when you say revolution, there's this immediate kind of reaction, and that is that word impossible. Because we're told it's impossible. We're told that this system, capitalism, is the best system that we can get. That it's permanent, that's a social order that'll last for eternity. We're told that change is slow, that we should simply vote or work for capitalist politicians or work within the system or simply accept that hardship is the way that it has to be and that there's no other choice for life. That, we're told that in the United States, the masses of people will never rise up and want to take political power. But, you know, it's interesting that there's an immediate reaction to the word revolution with the word impossible, because we do know that revolutions are possible, because they have happened. And we can see it throughout history and learn from it. So what can we learn from peasants in China who crushed emperors? From revolutionaries in Cuba who liberated the masses of poor and working people from a dictatorship, from a police state? What can we learn from slaves in Haiti who overthrew slave masters? From Black people in the South who organized against Jim Crow and faced the Klan? What can we learn about people in South Africa who defeated apartheid? Or workers, factory workers in Russia who beheaded the Tsar and had the first successful working class seizure of power ever on the planet? What do those who made revolutions and those who radically changed society when everyone said it was impossible, what do they teach us? They teach us that if you're oppressed, that you can fight your oppressor. That if you're affected by imperialism, then you can fight imperialism. If you hate racism, then you can fight racism. If you're repulsed by a system that puts profits over people's lives, over the health and growth of children, over the dignity and respect of the elderly, profits over the right of people around the world to live in peace, then you must stand and fight against those criminals at the top. They showed us that we can do that. They showed us that we can fight. And they taught us that you don't have to do it alone. They taught us to do it with others who think the same and who have had similar experiences, to stand side by side with others in your class, others affected by the same enemy. And don't just fight with them in the streets, but train with them, organize with them, study with them, learn from them and help them learn, not just to learn these things academically, but learn them as a team to become a tool with which to wage class warfare against the criminal billionaires and their system of exploitation and oppression, to become the thing that can wrest the death grip of capitalism from the planet and humanity and put it in the hands of the people. But most importantly, what they taught us is that if you fight, if you struggle, if you work, if you build, that you can win. And not only win, but win when they say it's impossible. Or so said the people who were overthrown. They showed us that no king is too powerful, no dictator is too strong, no government is too omnipotent, no system is permanent. They all crumble under the weight when the people get organized and exercise their massive power, the power of class unity. Today's feudal kings and queens, today's slave traders, today's colonial masters are the billionaire bankers and corporate shareholders. And like the masses of people who overthrew those oppressive systems of the past, you can be a part of overthrowing this oppressive system of capitalism. Sisters and brothers, we thank you for attending this conference on socialism. We hope you enjoyed the presentations, learned more about socialism and the struggle today. We hope you consider joining the PSL by filling out one of these forms that's in your packet. They're also at the front table, by talking to one of our members, by attending one of our future events. And if you've listened to this conference, it is clear that we need a new system, one for the people, for the planet, for humanity and dignity. So if you hate oppression, if you hate exploitation and sexism and racism and bigotry and war and poverty, if you dream of a better life, if you dream of a better world, of dignity, of justice, then we need to fight for it, together as a party, as professional revolutionaries, as comrades. We hope you take that step with us. Thank you.
Classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit. I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts. Packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion. Burn mics up to ashes, I make fascists clap their pants. Stanzas cure cultural cancer. I got tunes that move you to dance. Burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum. Getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis. My word act like nominally got, rhymingly packed. Punch, crash the fun.
run by metric tons, and plus my math, distribute cash among the classes, take from the thieving greedy bastard, give back like church hats or get past, collapse structure, fuck facades, I destruct the support beams and bars, wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction, flip the shit just like a brick throne, dethrone kings, bring the trees on, my tone rock like Gibraltar pop, hip hop hotter than a rocket shot, I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big talk, teach it to flee from the flock, walk off, switch shit, hit my target, drop like bombs in the form of carpets, I got the target locked on that all shit, pump your fist if you know where we are. That's a rap, boom bap, original rap at, take it to back, boom bap, boom bap. I'm talking true path, mastered the craft, the pupil, the prof, keep dropping math, boom bap, blast the bazooka rap. Boom bap, original rap.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
Royal City Uke Fest is thrilled to welcome James Hill and Anne Janelle to their evening stage performance on Saturday, September 30th at Dublin Street United Church, a physically accessible location. Together, they have toured in over 15 countries and conjure a sound that is intricate, enchanting, and engaging. And the day before, Royal City Uke Fest will be hosting a ukulele strum-along. Come to this free event at Dublin Street United Church on Friday, September 29th at 7 p.m. For more info and to purchase tickets, please visit royalcityukefest.com.
Close to Home, an eclectic mix of Canadian music on CFRU 93.3 FM. Thursday mornings at 7 a.m. with your host, Tom Rydell. I'll make it easier for you to get up and greet the day. Close to Home, Thursday mornings, 7 a.m.
I'm Maggie, mother of two campers at the nationally accredited Sunrise Therapeutic Riding and Learning Center, a place of belonging and acceptance for children and adults with special needs to participate in therapy, recreation, and life skills programs. I hope you'll join us on Saturday, September 30th for Sunrise's annual Hoofbeat Challenge fundraiser. Come with your family, walk your dog, ride your horse, or hike the beautiful Sunrise Trails. And join us afterwards for live music, lunch, a silent auction, and much more. Entry is a minimum of $50 in pledges raised, and there'll be goodie bags for the first 100 registrants. For more information, including accessibility, visit sunrise-therapeutic.ca or sign up on canadahelps.ca.
Hi, I'm Nicholas, and I ride at Sunrise. It is the best thing in my life. Please come to Hoofbeat Challenge and support riders like me. Thank you.
Listening to Back in the USSR.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, 90.3 and 89.7 FM. I'm Lynn Gary. Today's broadcast will focus on the actual purpose of U.S. military activity and expenditure abroad, and its splendid success in the Caribbean and Central America. Its creation? A pool of slave labor that can undermine the wages of U.S. workers while reaping enormous profits for transnational corporations. In our first hour, we'll continue with our lecture series by Dr. Michael Parenti. His talk today, The Sword and the Dollar. In the second hour, we'll hear from teenage workers in El Salvador and Haiti about how little they earn and eat. Your average Finger Lakes cow lives better than they do. And we'll hear from one of the survivors of a massacre in a Guatemalan village, whose people were killed wholesale to make way for a World Bank-sponsored dam project built to provide electricity for maquiladoras in the city. What you hear in today's program will outrage and disgust you. But this is about more than feeling compassion for someone far away. Our fates are tied to theirs. 500,000 U.S. apparel jobs have been lost to these maquiladoras as a result of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. And corporations are using their ability to export labor to force Americans to work harder for less. Last New Year's Eve, I was coming home on the thruway. It was 2 a.m., really cold and snowing hard. We pulled off at a gas station on the Weedsport exit. There was an old man in a beat-up car delivering newspapers in the cold and dark. The old man looked like a guy who worked hard all his life, and here he was, working for peanuts in the cold on New Year's Eve. Sadly, this guy probably thought he was doing honest work. It's not honest when people's lives are spent in labor that enriches others and leaves them poor. That is criminal. If you're old enough to remember the 60s, you may recall the glowing predictions of futurists that automation and technology would create a future filled with leisure and prosperity. This has come to pass, but only for a tiny minority. The rest of us are working harder for less. The fact is that less workers are needed due to technological advancements, and so prisons are being built at an accelerating rate to return that surplus humanity to profitability, as slave laborers working for a fraction of the minimum wage. And our hoodwinked people keep falling for the tough-on-crime rhetoric. The people imprisoned for murder, rape, and other violence represent a minority of prisoners. Two-thirds of the people in prison are there on non-violent drug convictions, and many of the others are simply poor. Who knows how many thousands have committed no crime at all, but are there simply because they are poor, young, and black, and have been framed to beef up the arrest statistics of corrupt police forces. And the corporate bosses laugh all the way to the bank. This program is actually a class in learning to read between the lines of the lies our so-called leaders spout. By the end of this course, you will gain a different understanding about what is meant by defending democracy, tough on crime, war on drugs, economic empowerment zone, and free trade. Now, Dr. Michael Parenti.
Welcome to People's Video Audio, a series of talks by author and political analyst Michael Parenti. His books include Democracy for the Few, Land of Vitals, Political Mythology in America, and Against Empire. The topic of today's talk is The Sword and the Dollar, the history of imperialism and the forced maldevelopment of the Third World. It was given in Marin, California, February 1994. Here's Michael Parenti.
Central America, as you know, like most of the Third World, is suffering from acute poverty and economic stagnation, and this is called underdevelopment. And this underdevelopment is treated in academia and in the media and by government officials elsewhere as an original historical condition. It's something that was always there. It's due to the poverty of the land. The climate makes people lazy. I learned that when I was a kid. I remember teachers saying that people in the warmer climates just don't work as hard as we do. You know, mañana, mañana, and all that. Whereas we in the temperate climates, we work hard. It's due to overpopulation. They have too many children. And it's due to cultural backwardness. These are the reasons given. The reasons given to explain poverty in the third world are the same as the reasons given to explain poverty in the United States itself, except the climatic one. But all these others are lazy, too many kids, blah, blah, the other thing. In fact, the lands of Central America are very rich lands. The lands of the third world throughout Asia, Africa, Latin America. That's why the Europeans went through all the trouble to go there to steal and plunder and settle them. In fact, these warm climates have produced ancient and magnificent civilizations back when the Europeans were still hunting pigs with sticks. There were great civilizations in places. In fact, they're more overpopulated today. They're more overpopulated today than they were in the earlier centuries before the Europeans came. So overpopulation is more a result of underdevelopment than a cause. In fact, the cultural backwardness, you know, that's a theme that's as old as Columbus. He was using it to justify enslaving people. I look at the people in the 16th century and I said, the Europeans had supremacy, really cultural supremacy, in just two areas. One was the whole area of navigational transportation, and the other was in the instruments of war and armaments and firepower. And it was that superior firepower, not superior civilization, that brought them to the positions of supremacy that they are in now. Through the centuries of colonization, there were other elaborate theories that were framed. One of the most interesting is the one that came along about the mid to late 19th century, that the colonized people are biologically backward, biologically undeveloped. They're savages. That the inferior level of cultural evolution, this assumes they have an inferior level, is commensurate with an inferior biological evolution. None other than Charles Darwin himself. You know, I learned in school that Herbert Spencer was the social Darwinist. Remember Herbert Spencer in the School of Social Darwinism, where they took Darwin's scientific findings and they applied them to the economy. Well, when I read Darwin, I found out that Darwin himself was a social Darwinist. He had all these kinds of theories about how naturally inferior these people were. Well, how were they really culturally inferior? Their architectural skills, horticulture, crafts, hunting, fishing technology, midwifery, medicines, herbs, and their tribal democratic practices were often much better and more advanced, much more an object of admiration than anything that could have been found in Europe at that time. I mean, we mustn't romanticize these original societies, some of which did have unjust and cruel practices, you know, of their own. But generally, you know, I looked at them and I say, you know where they lagged behind mostly? They lagged behind 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th century Europe. This is the list I could come up with. Hangings, murders, syphilis, gonorrhea, smallpox, typhoid, bubonic plague, poverty, both urban and rural, slavery, prostitution, religious wars, and inquisitional witch hunts. Those areas, I would say, Europe took first place in those centuries. The poverty of Central America and the Third World, masses of people crowded into urban slums, living in utter destitution in rural villages at times, illiteracy, unemployment, hunger, disease, comes because the land is given over to commercial cash export crops and absentee ownership. It comes because they're growing coffee, sugar, beef for export instead of beans and rice for indigenous consumption, home consumption, domestic consumption. The labor and the resources of Central America are devoted to one thing primarily, capital accumulation. Especially emphasis on the labor. I gave the example once of El Salvador, where I was looking at who's in El Salvador. You know who's in El Salvador, the Fortune 500? Everybody. Cargill, General Motors, all these corporations are down there in Central America, Harvester, Chase Manhattan, in El Salvador. And I said, what's in El Salvador? Some sugar, some cotton, what are they all doing there? And they're down there for that other ingredient in the productive process, the one that really creates surplus value, which is human labor. And the Salvadoran workers are producing everything from energy rods to baby powder to cooking powder, baking powder, rubber tires, computers, automobile parts. All this is being done for other consumption markets. It's called outsourcing, where the companies go down and bring the stuff and use the cheap labor. And all those transportation costs to do that make it worth it. It's still more profitable to do that and to have those things put together in El Salvador than in Ohio, because in Ohio you pay people $10 an hour, and down there you pay them 60 cents an hour. So the labor and resources are devoted to one thing primarily: capital accumulation. Self-sustenance and self-employment gives way to wage labor. And that pattern is very striking in the Third World, throughout the Third World. From 1970 to 1980, the number of wage workers in the Third World grew from 72 million to 120 million. And the rate is accelerating. That same pattern exists in the United States. Back in the middle of the last century, early part of the 1800s, 75% of this population, the U.S. population, was self-employed. Today, it's about 8%. I mean, it's been a gradual decline, 40s, 20, 15, you go right down, it's down to about 8 now. And many self-employed people are really self-employed on the sufferance of some other larger supplier. The essence of capital investment is not to uplift a country or develop it, nor to bring civilization. Those are the patronizing ethnocentric rationales that are given. I mean, we do hear that the developed countries in the North must help the underdeveloped countries. What does underdeveloped mean? It means retarded in some way. You just didn't go through a certain process. They're not as capable of evolving. They need aid. They need Peace Corps volunteers to show them how to do things. They need missionaries and movies and McDonald's and Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse, especially Mickey Mouse. And cognizant that underdeveloped carries some negative connotations, the Third World nations and the UN and the Wall Street Journal and most communist parties in the world, publications left, right, and center, all now use another term, which I do not ever use in my writings, a slightly less insulting but hilariously inaccurate term that's called developing nation. So they're just late bloomers. I use third world because I find developing to be a very deceptive term, a euphemistic way of saying underdeveloped. It presumes that poverty was an original condition. It presumes that these countries are developing when, in fact, many of them are conditioned. Worse. People in these countries don't need to be taught how to farm. They need the land to farm and the implements. They don't need to be taught how to fish. They know how to fish. They need the boats and the nets and access to shore frontage and bays and oceans. They need someone to stop the chemical plants from dumping their toxic effusions into the waters and rivers. They don't need to be convinced that they should use hygienic standards. They don't need a Peace Corps volunteer to tell them that. To tell them to boil their water, especially when they can't find any wood to light a fire with. They need the conditions that will allow them to have clean drinking water and clean clothes and homes. They don't need nutritional advice on balanced diets from North Americans. They need food, and they usually know better than the North Americans what foods serve their nutritional needs, usually. Underdevelopment, what's called underdevelopment, is a condition which is forcefully imposed on these countries through history. One of the most dramatic examples is India. In 1810, India was exporting more textiles, finished mass market textiles, not just those beautiful, exquisite silks that we always associate with India. Mass market textiles was exporting more textiles to England than England was exporting to India, and more to China, and more to Egypt, more to a number of other places. In 1810, by 1830, the British had put up prohibitive barriers and blocked out Indian goods and had moved in and were dumping their goods in India. And within a matter of another 10 years, the great textile centers of Dhaka and Madras were turned into ghost towns. And the people were sent back out on the land to do what? To raise the cotton, the raw materials that would be used in the factories of Manchester and Lancashire and London. so that India was reduced to being a cow, like much of the third world, to be milked and not to be developed. And by 1850, India's debt had grown to 53 million pounds. And from 1850 to 1900, the per capita income in India dropped by two-thirds, almost two-thirds, 65%. I mean, that's an incredible drop. So we always associate India with poverty, the masses of poverty. That's not their original condition. They're not an underdeveloped country. England underdeveloped India. Ireland is another example. Ireland is a country that's not usually associated with the Third World. Well, it's the first colony, England's very first. It was the first imperialism. It goes back to, what, 13th century, 14th century, whatever. Engels was in Ireland, spent some time there. Frederick Engels, Karl Marx's collaborator, for the benefit of some who might not recognize the name. In 1856, he wrote, quote, "How often have the Irish started out to achieve something, and every time they have been crushed politically and industrially. By consistent oppression, they have been artificially converted into an utterly impoverished nation." Very interesting wordage. Artificially converted. And so the same with Central America. Artificially converted. The Mayan Indians in Guatemala had a better diet. They had more calories, more protein, and better conditions of health in the early 16th century before the Europeans came than they do have today. They had more artists, more musicians, more architects, more horticulturalists than they do today. They are not underdeveloped. They've been overexploited. They've been maldeveloped. The legacy of U.S. economic dominance is not only hunger and strife and misery, but an economic structure that bears very little functional relationship to the needs of Central America, of the people of Central America. The most important characteristic of the region's economy is that it's dominated by a network of international corporations which themselves are beholden to parent companies that have their place in North America, Europe, and Japan, roughly in that order, especially North America. If there's any harmonization, by the way, of these interests, it's with the global investor classes between them. They're harmonizing their interests. That's what's getting integrated, not the indigenous economies of these countries. NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, is an attempt to rationalize this. It gives the total green light. It wipes away whatever political controls that democratic forces have been able to institute. NAFTA will not integrate the economies. You hear that talk all the time. These economies are going to be integrated. I heard John Chancellor, that fatuous commentator, wisdom peddler, saying, well, there was a time when we had small villages and we had to move to a regional economy. Then a regional economy wasn't enough. We had to move to a national economy. And now we're all going to have to move to a global economy. Just that's all. Simple as that. That's all it is. A benign, ordinary development. It's not an integration into a global economy because these capital investments, untrammeled as they are, actually fragment the productive forces in these countries, any productive forces that operate for the needs of the people. Just look in our own country. Just look at what free trade and mobility of capital has done to the industrial Midwest of the U.S. We now even have a term for it. We call it the Rust Belt. That's a remarkable admission, isn't it? But it's something that just happened, you see. The Central American economies, like those in most places in the Third World, remain fragmented and unintegrated, both between each other, between the various countries, and within themselves, both in the flow of capital and goods and in technology and organization. A global economy, a world economy that has little to do with the needs of the people of the world. That's a rather remarkable thought when you think about it, huh? The other legacy of economic domination is political suppression and unspeakable atrocities. The counterinsurgency funded and led by the United States in El Salvador against a broadly based liberation movement led to the deaths of what? By now, maybe 70,000 Salvadorans killed. Many thousands more believed to have been murdered by right-wing death squads. 540,000 have fled into exile. Another quarter of a million have been displaced or forced into resettlement camps. This is all one little country, El Salvador. a country of only 4 million people. But just about everybody has been directly or indirectly affected, has either suffered death or suffered a terrible loss of loved ones or close ones. The Salvadoran army massacred whole villages suspected of being sympathetic to the guerrillas. An eyewitness victim interview taken by then Congresswoman Barbara Mikulski of a Salvadoran peasant woman, quote, "Many members of my family were killed. I saw children around the age of 8 being raped. And then the soldiers would take their bayonets and make mincemeat out of them. With their guns, they would shoot at their faces. The army cut people up and put soap and coffee in their stomachs as a mocking. They would slit the stomach of a pregnant woman and take the child out as if they were taking eggs out of an iguana. That is what I saw. And El Salvador today in the U.S. media and by our U.S. political leaders is called a democracy." Manuel de Conceição, a peasant leader in Brazil, was arrested by the Brazilian security police when the junta ran Brazil. Police who had been schooled at U.S. Army bases in the latest methods of counterinsurgency and interrogation for his crime of protesting the economic conditions of his life and of his people, this is how Manuel was treated. "For 4 months, I was heavily tortured by the Army in Rio de Janeiro and then in the Naval Information Center. Near death, I was taken to the hospital for the sixth time. The beatings had been so severe that my body was one big bruise. The blood clotted under my skin and all the hair on my body fell out. They pulled out all my fingernails. They poked needles through my sexual organs and used a rope to drag me across the floor by my testicles. Right afterwards, they hung me upside down by my ankles. They hung me handcuffed from a grating and tied my penis so I could not urinate. They forced me to stand for 3 days without food or drink. They gave me so many drugs that my eardrums burst and I am impotent. They nailed my penis to a table for 24 hours. They tied me up like a pig and threw me into a pool so that I nearly drowned. They put me in a completely dark cell where I remained for 30 days, urinating and defecating in the same place where I had to sleep. They fed me only bread soaked in water. They put me in a rubber box and turned on a siren. For 3 days, I neither ate nor slept, and I nearly went mad." This was done by the defenders of the Western world, by defenders of the free way, you see, the free market. With the aid...
What do you live for?
CIA and other factors.
Is it for your crew?
Victims of these military...
For overcoming obstacles? Live for what you want.
For defenders of democracy, well,
so what do you live for?
The U.S. tortured people with electric shock. They forced victims, and this is... have testified that we are professionals. We use certain methods to get some to elicit information, and we have to do this, and it's a tough job and all that. And the guys who finance them, who sit in Langley, Virginia, say, heck, I mean, You know, it's a jungle out there. I'm not that happy about the kind of methods we sometimes have to use, but when you're facing these tough kind of people, you got to use the same methods they do, and so forth, so on. In other words, you always justify your crimes by saying that your victim was the criminal. That's a rational process of training torturers for what is a rational set of interests. They didn't go down there for torturing, just for the sake of torturing. They used torture in order to be down there and stay down there and defend their privileges and their interests. I want to make that point because sometimes imperial domination is explained as arising from the will to dominate, an innate desire for territorial expansion, a territorial imperative. But in fact, territorial imperialism is not the dominant mode. It hasn't been in generations. Today, there's very relatively little colonial dominion. I mean, the U.S. controls Puerto Rico, Guam, a few other places. What you have today is neo-imperialism, where the country has its nominal independence, its own president and its own currency and its own police and all that, and all you do is you control its exports and imports, its land, as we did with Cuba, sugar, tobacco, its tourist trade, and all those other things. You allow them the trappings of sovereignty while you control the wealth. I heard someone at the World Affairs Council, I went there to hear a friend speak, and someone got up from the audience, there's a lot of academics and professionals and all that, World Affairs Council types, and he said, well, you know, ironically, Cuba has come full cycle since the days before the revolution. Before the revolution, the tourist trade was only for the Yankees. The hotels and beaches were only for the foreigners, and the Cubans needed